That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to FUBAR Radio. It is time for That Money Show with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And I will not repeat what you just heard if you were listening to FUBAR Radio. My mother would slap me around the back of the head for that kind of language. Anyway, it's time for That Money Show, so I need you to just change your mindset completely. We're here to teach you about money, make you better with money, and, well, I'm going to say it again, teach you about money. That thing that schools probably should add to the curriculum by now, but they're not, so we've made an entire show just for it. You're welcome. It's a pretty good idea if you ask me. If you are new around here, stick around because we're going to have a whole bunch of fun where the end goal is within 1 hour, you will be better with your finance knowledge than you are right now. And we're going to do it a few ways. We're going to bring up the news, but not the boring news, the stuff that actually affects the money in your pocket. Probably going to have a little chat about Oasis at some point and some of the ticket sales that have been going on there. You know, boiling everyone's blood at the moment. Unless you've got tickets for the cheapest price possible, then you're probably absolutely buzzing. And we've got a few guests that are going to come on today as well. We've got Dr. Matt Grimes, Senior Lecturer in Music Industries and Radio at Birmingham City University. You can probably guess the topic that he's going to be talking about. And Sammy Ellard King, a financial educator on social media. You've probably seen him before if you have a phone and an internet connection. Anyway, shall we dive into the news then? I think it's about time. It sounds like a good idea. What's going on? Well, Labour again. It used to be Conservatives till about a month ago, but now Labour is the newest word on every single news story. They are advancing plans to regulate buy now, pay later. BNPL, heard of it? You know, you go into a store, you're like, can't afford 100 quid. And they're like, did you know we do BNPL? And you're like, what's that? And they're like, you can pay us £25 over the next 4 months with 0% interest. Sounds really good. You might have heard of companies like Klarna or Clearpay that offer these kinds of services. What do they do? Well, they're basically trying to incentivize you to spend more money. Very simple and to the point, by making things sound or become more affordable to you. So you can't buy it up front. Why not break up those payments into a lot of little chunks? And, you know, we're not even going to add any interest on in a lot of the cases. And voila, you can afford it. Not going to lie, as a personal finance, I suppose, educator in this industry and all that kind of good stuff, I'm not a fan of this topic, full stop. I don't like BNPL. I just feel like it's, what's the word? Incentivizing people to spend beyond their limits. Obviously, I know that it's a thing. A lot of people do it in order to afford a lot of stuff. But it tends to be in the case of when you want to buy something that you want, not necessarily something you need. So in which case I would prefer you to save up for 4 months to buy it rather than buy it now and then spend it over 4 months. Does that make sense? I might just be being a bit of a nerd, but that's just my humble opinion. Because ultimately, if you do start to miss payments or you can't end up paying back that item that you thought you could afford because you spent it over 4 months, that's when things start to go bad. And that's when things, you know, interest payments, debt, you know, the D word, we don't like to talk about it. We try to avoid it at all costs possible. Yeah, that's what comes to happen. So, Labour want to regulate it. I'm actually two thumbs up to this. I don't always give two thumbs up to Labour and government policies, but this one is a two thumbs up because it's a financial service, it's a financial product, so therefore consumers need to have some kind of protection, and that's where regulation comes into effect. So how would regulation with BNPL happen? Because right now, literally, anyone can go and use it. You want something, you want to split the payments in four, done. No background check, nothing. You're in. So they want to bring in affordability checks on customers so you can check credit records, credit scores, all that kind of stuff to make sure you can actually afford to pay it off. Makes sense, right? You're basically borrowing money from someone. So that I'm again greenlighting that idea. And also to make sure that customers are given clearer information on signing up to be able to complain to the Financial Ombudsman Service when something goes wrong. So in a lot of these cases, things do go wrong. People are charged interest when they shouldn't be charged interest. People have been overcharged for for a month or overall for the entire thing of the product. A lot of things go wrong, and people often don't know, where can we actually go and look for support? Normally, the answer is the Financial Ombudsman, if you don't know what that means. Google it, financial, spelt the word financial, ombudsman, O-M-B-U-D-S-M-A-N. Don't know why I felt to spell it, but I feel like ombudsman is one of those words that you'll hear it and you'll have no idea how to spell it. So I thought I would do that for you. This is all really good stuff. So they're not getting rid of BNPL. Don't worry, you can still use your Klarna and all that kind of stuff. But they are starting to bring in rules. I think it makes sense. Because remember, you're able to split your payments up into installments with no fees. And they're so popular. Apparently over 17 million adults in the UK used them in 2022 alone. That's a huge percentage of the country that are using BNPL. So regulation, I think it's a good idea. Should you be using it in the first place? I would personally try and avoid it at all costs possible. Remember, save up for 4 months rather than buying it now and then splitting that cost over 4 months. Why? A, you're avoiding your chance of going into debt full stop. B, you're avoiding your chance to go to debt in full stop. And C, you're avoiding your chances of going into debt full stop. I think those are all pretty good reasons. Also, if you flip it around and wait 4 months to buy that item that you want but you don't need, in 4 months' time, you probably might kind of get over that hump that and start to resist that urge to actually buy that item in the first place. You might look back at yourself 4 months ago and think to yourself, I never would have, like, why did I even want that in the first place? And there you go. It's another way to save money. That is what we do on The Money Show. We've actually just made you better with your money in about 5 minutes. So you can go now, but I'd recommend you don't, because if you've got good value in the first five, you're probably going to get good value in the next 55. What else is going on? Spending money abroad. Put your hand up if you do that. Well, if you go abroad, your hand should have gone up, because everyone spends money when they're abroad, right? But there is a huge amount of people getting it wrong, and it's so simple. And what do I mean by getting it wrong? I mean, you are doing things like withdrawing money at really crappy exchange rates so that you are essentially spending more whilst traveling than ever before. You are getting charged fees at ATM machines when you're traveling. Again, pretty silly. I wouldn't want to do that if I could avoid it. But let's take a look at some of the statistics right now that have been done by Compare the Market. You know them? Compare the Market, Compare the Meerkat. Good shout out for them. Nearly 3 in 10 holidaymakers have opted for currency exchange just before their flight. So we're talking in the airport or just after landing or something around. Well, it says just before their flight, so it's in the airport. Don't know why I'm trying to overcomplicate it. But I'm probably assuming that that's 3 out of 10. Another 2 out of 10 have probably gone for the exchange when they've landed in the next airport they're going to. Just going to say this right now. Airports have the worst exchange rates possible. They know that you have no other options at that point. You are desperate and you will do whatever exchange rate they offer. So they are awful. You are getting conned out of money. If you're changing something like 20 quid, fine. That's not a lot of money. But some people are changing hundreds of pounds in airports. Like, it infuriates me. That is such a bad idea. So that was 3 out of 10 holiday people that are doing that. But currently, that is actually standing at 51% of people between 16 and 24. So great, well done. At the age when you have the least amount of money, you are doing the worst amount of things with it. That sounds absolutely brilliant. But if you're aged over 55, only 12% of you are doing that. In other words, if you're 55, you're probably a little bit more experienced with travel. And, you know, exchanging your money in the airport, not the best idea. We've also got 1 in 5 people saying they withdrew money from a cash point or bank during their last holiday abroad and were charged a fee. Remember, that number gradually goes up, 26% of 16 to 24-year-olds. And a third. Oh, it's actually worse for an even older generation, 25 to 34-year-olds. You guys really, honestly, should have learned by that point. So, you want to welcome to the money show, well, that money show, where I'm officially going to teach you how to spend the least amount of money abroad. Okay, number one, you can book a lot of things on your phone. If you can do it on your phone, you can just use your normal card unless it requires you to pay in a foreign fee. But if it allows you to pay in your current fee online, you can pre-book a bunch of things. Booking.com, I don't know, hotels.com, Trivago, Viator, all of these things allow you to book services in other countries in your own currency, therefore paying no exchange fees. Tip number one. Tip number two, let's say you do need to exchange and have some physical cash. What you're going to do is actually try and think, well, does the place I'm going, does it have ATMs? Does it have a lot of ability to use my card a lot? Will I actually need cash? If the answer is no, withdraw what you need a little bit. I always like to have about £50 worth of whatever foreign currency I'm going into. But go and find the best place in where near where you live. So, for example, I like to go to, I think the M&S do a travel exchange at a really, really good exchange rate. The post office is another one. There's a bunch of online services that can do it as well, where you can literally buy it online at really low or really good exchange rates and get that money delivered to you. The only issue I think with the online one is sometimes you need to have a really, like, there's a quite a high minimum threshold of how much you need to order. But there you go. Then, what are you going to do next? You are going to get a bunch of cards that are really good for you to travel with, okay? Card number one, if you can, and if you are a responsible credit card user, you are going to get yourself a travel credit card, one that doesn't charge fees and one that has a really good exchange rate. And even better, some have perks like cashback and points, okay? And that is the card you're going to use when you are spending abroad. But if you're not responsible enough for credit cards, think about things like Monzo and Revolut that literally allow you to spend on foreign soil at the exact exchange rate, no fees, if you are tapping with your card or inserting your card into machine. You're going to use those, okay? But let's say you do need cash in those countries and you can't pay by card. Because remember, if you're paying by card, there should be zero fees involved. We are past that stage. Stop using that crappy card still in your wallet. Use one of the ones I just mentioned. But if you do need to withdraw money, Monzo and Revolut, again, give you a certain amount you can withdraw every month. I think it's somewhere like £200 per card. That's why I have a Monzo and I have a Revolut. £400 to withdraw for free. Yes, sometimes the ATMs in like a lot of kind of smaller or less developed countries do charge you. That's unavoidable. But normally, if they are a free ATM and you use one of those cards, that will be the cheapest way possible. And remember, when you are paying with one of those cards in a foreign country, you always pay in the local currency. You never, never let the machine convert it back into pounds or whatever currency you have. Okay, there you go. There's your rules. Sounds pretty good. So we don't just discuss the news. I told you, we tell you how it is actually affecting the money in your wallet. I've basically just given you some great advice how to reduce your spending abroad. That's pretty much it. I was going to bring in another story about how 0% interest cards, balance transfer cards, are actually getting worse right now. Not too much time for that, but I would look into it. So if you are someone that's looking to consolidate credit card debt, you've got a bunch of debt, really high interest rates, there are things called 0% balance transfer cards, where for a small fee, you can move all of it onto a card, and for a normally like 15, 20, 24 month period, you will pay 0% interest as long as you can pay it off in that time. Of course, if you get to the end of that period and you haven't paid it off in full yet, you start having to pay quite hefty interest charges as well. So just be aware that a lot of these deals are starting to drop. The idea that there used to be ones that are 30 months and are now dropping to 25 months, just something to be aware of, again, if you are looking to do a balance transfer. Anyway, that's all for now. And if you stick around, I am going to be joined straight after this little break by Dr. Matt Grimes, the senior lecturer in music industries and radio at Birmingham City University, to have a little chat about a famous band who just got back together after about, was it 16 years? And their ticket prizes are the talk of the town. Anyway, stick around. We'll catch you soon.
Fubar Radio.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird. Funny and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, do you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be like. They see like the gym and the muscles and the tattoos and they think I'm going to be like this, like serious, like fuck boy, like lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me and I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It's the sound of your mates alive. Is getting to more gigs this year and the next. It's the sound of saying, I got you, mate. It's the sound of mates enjoying even more of this. It's the sound of mates getting home instead of here. click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't. Think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more.
You wanna go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
Politics Uncensored.
I felt like it was a little bit, they wanted to go viral. They wanted the clip to end up on socials and be able to go viral, and there was nothing substantive on it. So to be honest, it kind of pissed me off because I thought it was a throwaway comment made for social media as opposed to actually giving voters information they need when they enter the voting booth.
Totally agree. And I also found the whole, I think he said something about Keir Starmer's strings being pulled by senior members of the Labour Party. I found that slightly conspiratorial.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Well, hello and welcome back to That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with me, That Money Guy. And we will be joined very shortly by Dr. Matt Grimes to talk all about Oasis. But I want to come and explain some context for you first. So I don't know if anyone's been following the news at all. I assume most people are fully aware of what's been going on. But Ticketmaster and Oasis have come under a huge amount of criticism for applying something called dynamic pricing to tickets for this massive event happening next year. So fans basically have been going onto the website. They queued from 9 a.m. I think it was on Saturday morning when the tickets were released, expecting a certain price for tickets. I think they were released at around £120 from £130, something like that. And they got on, they were ready to buy their tickets, and it said £350. They had over doubled from getting into the queue to getting up to where they were up to, which is absolutely crazy and obviously has a lot of people fuming at this because they thought they were getting one price ticket. They actually weren't getting that ticket once they'd logged in, queuing for absolutely hours. And obviously this has had a huge amount of backlash from this idea of tickets not being affordable for concerts. And I've got a whole bunch of questions around this about how are tickets priced in the first place? Who's actually getting all of that money? Are they allowed to do this? Is this legal? How does this hurt or help or hinder their reputation? But it's a good thing because I'm not going to be the one answering these questions. I'm actually being joined, like I said, right now by Dr. Matt Grimes, the Senior Lecturer in Music Industries and Radio at Birmingham City University. Dr. Matt, welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am doing excellently, and I'm very excited to ask you all about this because, you know, music and concerts is the hottest topic of the news right now. I will admit, I didn't go for a ticket myself. I'm not the biggest music fan myself, and probably I couldn't be bothered to sit around for 5 hours to try and get onto a website. And also, once I'd missed kind of the pre-release or whatever happened, I was like, there's absolutely no chance of this happening. But this has caused quite a lot of controversy, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And to be honest with you, not for the first time. You may remember many years ago when Glastonbury tickets were quite expensive. There was a limited amount of those tickets and people were going onto the website to get tickets for Glastonbury Festival and they were happy to pay upwards of £200 when they didn't even know who was going to be performing. This was way before the arts had even been announced. The websites crashed. There's all that problems there, but people got their tickets. And it almost seems as though the music itself was secondary to the experience of going. Well, clearly with Oasis now, and we've had a similar thing with Taylor Swift this summer on her global tour. I think Bruce Springsteen played in Cardiff earlier this year, £300 a ticket. You know, that clearly people out there, I wouldn't say they're happy to pay that money, but they're willing to pay the money. And I think one of the things we have to be mindful of here is it goes back to economics, really. It's supply and demand. if there is a limited supply of something, then clearly you can demand not exactly what you want, but close to a combination of what you think you could charge or what you would like to charge versus what you think the market could withstand.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was somebody somewhere with the Oasis tickets who was sat there thinking, right, how much money would we like to make? How much money do you think we could get away with charging? How much money do you think people would be prepared to pay? And somebody's crunched those numbers, the cost of putting on the events versus the amount of revenue they would generate based on the amount of limited seats or availability that there is. So it's done on an economic basis. There are a lot of people, though, that need to get paid from that money. It's not all going to be going to the Gallagher brothers or any of these other artists. I mean, the Gallagher brothers themselves allegedly, and I'm using these terms very, very carefully because I don't really want to see myself in front of their lawyers, but allegedly their net worth is around 50 million each. So these gigs that they're putting on next year allegedly will bring them in, again, around about 50 million each. So it will double their net worth. Wow. From putting on 14 performances, I think it is.
That's
and
incredible.
Potentially that will include clearly all the merchandise sales as well. They've said they're not going to televise this. They've been very careful how they've chosen their words there, because that doesn't mean they won't make a film.
Yes.
You understand what I mean?
I understand exactly what you mean.
Broadcasting a live performance on telly and then making a documentary film that they could then network out to Netflix or other platforms, Apple or whatever, that would be willing to pay for it. So, but there are a lot of people to have to pay from this. And you've got the venue itself that costs to hire. You've got the venue staff that work there. You've got the security that work there. You've got the
police,
live
probably.
Touring company.
Extra services from public sector. There's probably a huge amount,
so
right?
So you've also got the roadies. You've got the company that move all the equipment around between the venues. You've got the people printing and then people selling merchandise. You've got road crew. You've got the PR companies. You've got the marketing companies. You've got the ticket agencies to pay. You've got your management company to pay. You've got your live tour manager to pay. You've got all of the entourage that exist around those different organizations and companies that all have to be paid. Everybody, nobody's doing this as a charity event.
Yeah,
you know, they all want their cut. Whilst it might seem like a lot of money at the outset, let's not think that that money just goes straight into the pocket of the Gallagher brothers, because it clearly doesn't.
I think there's a huge chunk that is going into their back pockets at the end of the day. And I know they're also not doing it for free. This is very much a money-making scheme for them. I mean, they had quite the fight. It took quite a long time to get them back together. And unless about 10 years ago they went, if we can hold out another 10 years, we can probably triple the amount we'll make of this.
Well, without slipping in an Oasis pun, maybe it was all part of their master plan. But we will see. I mean, I don't think any of us will ever know why they've decided to do these reunion gigs. And let's be clear, they are reunion gigs. They are not reforming. But then maybe, just maybe, that they're going to be testing the water to see, actually, could we work together again? Could we go and make more music and produce some new material? Who knows? But yes, they will be. I think these gigs will gross around £400 million. But then there's all these people that need paying out of that. And then
absolutely, ultimately
they will end up with somewhere in the region of potentially £50 million each doing this.
So, my question is, if you go back 15, 20 years ago, it felt like, you know, you and your mates could all get to a concert of an artist that you pretty much liked. I know we are talking about, you know, the peak level artist right now. An Oasis reunion is something that, you know, wasn't even dreamed about 5 years ago. But it did feel like you could go to a concert with your mates and come back and not be broke. And those artists back in the day were still selling out stadiums, not just arenas. Yeah. They were selling out, you know, Wembley Stadium. And they were still selling it out and making a lot of money from these tours. And I know inflation's been bad recently, but it hasn't quite been a couple of £100 for the average person bad. No. I understand this is a money-making thing and there's that as well. But why so much? Why does it feel like you do need to sell an arm, an egg and a kidney to get to a concert these days?
Yeah, well, I mean, by the end of four gigs over the year, you'll have no internal organs left.
Yeah, there you go.
To part with. Well, I mean, again, you know, I talked earlier about the economic model. You know, we live in a capitalist society that works on supply and demand, simple as that. And, you know, the Gallaghers do a job. Their job is performing music. That it may seem different, but it's a job like any other, like working at Nando's or something or whatever. You know, you do your job. And, you know, where you're not necessarily making a lot of money from selling music nowadays, because we know the streaming platforms don't pay a lot. For artists, live performance is where they get most of their income. So they do mitigate for some of that as well in those live performances. But I think the interesting thing here is that COVID and Brexit really impacted heavily on the live music sector. I mean, heavily. If you imagine pre-COVID, it was a buoyant live music sector that employed tens of thousands of people, most of them being freelancers. And there was regular tours and there was regular venues for people to go on tour in circuits to go and do these events. There was festivals. There were big venue gigs. Oasis did in Ebworth, you know, tickets there. They weren't cheap, but they were, didn't seem as seemingly as expensive as tickets are now. But what happened post-COVID? During COVID, of course, the live music sector shut. You know, nobody was allowed to go out.
Yeah.
And there was no... So these people that have been working in that sector for 15, 20 years... suddenly had to find other work. And a lot of them, not knowing when COVID would be over, went and then ended up getting jobs elsewhere. Some of them continued working in the music industry in other areas. Some of them went as far as retraining to become plumbers, carpenters, driving vans, delivering for Amazon or whatever. And of course, that then got me into a situation over 18 months, 2 years, where they're getting a regular income. And they can budget better because they're not freelancing. They know that they're going to get a regular income. Yeah. So anyway, COVID goes, or sorry, it slackens off. The live sector starts to gently and slowly rebuild itself. But one of the big issues there was a lack of staff or skilled personnel to go back and work in the live music sector.
So the
sector.
Cost of them has those gone
that,
up.
Those that had it could charge a lot of money for their services.
Ah, there we go. And that's being passed on to the consumer.
On top of that, there was also the facilities companies that provided, there was less of them because a lot of them had gone out of business. So the ones that existed could charge more. But even the cost of the equipment now, because of inflation and other market forces, has increased the cost of putting on a live event. So that has gone up, one could argue, in line with inflation, but also in line with supply and demand in a different direction, not from the audience, but from the industry itself. So these things have to be factored in.
How much responsibility, though, do you think does fall on the artist? Because they are, you know, they know that there are going to be diehard fans that will do anything they can to be at that concert, and they will pay whatever it costs, regardless of the actual financial impact on their life. How much responsibility do you think lies with that? The same way, like I was thinking about this the other day, that the Premier League, okay, again, diehard football fans, they capped ticket prices for away fans because they know that it's the most diehard, most ultra fans are the ones that will go to the away games. And so they capped it at a very reasonable price. Now, I'm not saying it's quite like regulatory bodies need to start getting involved at this kind of thing, because like you said, if there is a ticket to be bought, a ticket will be sold. But does an artist not have to think to themselves, you know, these are my fans, I have some responsibility to them to make this a little bit more affordable?
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. And, you know, whilst I wouldn't expect anybody to go out and work for free unless they chose to, there is a point at which you say, right, well, how much money do I really need?
Doubling my net worth in one show?
Yeah.
Or 14?
Versus how much do I want versus what can I successfully do to keep my fan base on board? And I think there is, you mentioned the Premiership League. And I remember, you know, when I was younger, and I'm getting on a bit now, you know, football was a working class sport, you know. And then the Premiership League came into existence and suddenly a lot of working class people couldn't afford to take their families or go to the football. And then they started introducing different measures to try and make it more affordable. And some clubs did a really good job of that, some not so well. Mm-hmm. I think there's an opportunity in the music business to do something similar through maybe fan club memberships, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's one to do through different tiers of different ticketing prices.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there's also, in many respects, and I know that the government are looking into this on the base of this dynamic ticketing that took place over the weekend, of looking at the rules and regulations around the selling of tickets for these events. And I don't think for a moment any intervention would necessarily stop artists from performing. I can't see them saying, well, we're not going to make enough money, we're not going to do it. Because I think if you're a musician, you know, one of your passions is getting out there and performing. So I think, you know, artists will still perform. We had a similar thing with, you know, selling music, or, you know, musicians will make music.
Yeah,
that's in their blood. It's their passion. You know, whether they make money from it or not, they're going to continue to make music. But let's allow them to make a living out of it, because we need those people. We need music plays a huge part in everybody's
lives.
So we need people to be making music. Let's not put them off.
I've got one last question for you, if that's okay. There's a lot of young people that listen to this show. They are probably the ones that would like to go to these, but maybe can't afford it just yet. Do you have any tips on how to get or start going to these kind of level of shows, potentially on a budget in some way, shape or form, something that you might have experienced or have learned, you know, some sneaky ideas? Because the only one that I can come up with right now is start applying to jobs as a steward right now, and maybe you'll be picked on the day for the show you want to go to. I can't think of anything else.
Well, I mean, there's a degree of truth in that, and I think that's a really useful suggestion. And, you know, for some of these big festivals like Glastonbury, you can apply to work there, and you work for a number of hours a day, but then you get a lot of time off to go and enjoy the festival as well. So I think there are ways around it. But if you wanted a really good starting point for this, I would suggest that young people on limited budgets go and support local music. You know, grassroots venues in your town or city. The Music Venues Trust say that one venue a week is closing in the UK because it can't afford to stay open. Go and see local bands or bands that don't charge as much. Go and keep those venues open so you'll have a stream of music coming to your town on a regular basis. And don't forget, it's those little dingy pubs and nightclubs that Oasis cut their teeth.
Yep.
Taylor Swift was the same. Every musician started off in those little clubs. Go and support local music. You could be at the very beginning of the next big thing. And
absolutely.
Say, do you know what? And you could say to all your mates, have bragging rights in a few years' time, and say, I remember seeing that band, the first gig they ever did. There was me, there was an old man in the corner with a dog and a bit of string, and a couple at the back snogging each other.
There we go.
And look where they are now. And, you know, so
brilliant.
support local music, because you will discover the next big Oasis there. You will discover the next big Taylor Swift there, but for a fraction of the cost.
Dr. Matt, I think that's a brilliant way to end it. I think it's excellent advice. So thank you very much for your time.
You're absolutely welcome. It's been a pleasure.
All the best. Well, there we go. That was Dr. Matt Grimes giving you some advice. Potentially Oasis isn't right for you this summer. I do want to quickly share with you money tip of the week, if that's okay, if you just listen to me for 1 second. And it actually was a bit of a reiteration point, so it's not even going to take too much of your time. Earlier, we said a whole new story about saving money whilst abroad. Now, this is my tip for you right now. Go and get the card, even if you don't have a trip coming up. If you have a credit card, like you've got a good credit score, go and get yourself a good credit card for traveling right now, even if that trip isn't planned. Go and get that Monzo. Go and get that Revolut. Go and get one of the competitors that they have, even if that trip isn't coming up. Because I can promise you, what will happen is you book your flight, it'll be 2 days before, and you'll say, ah, shit, I forgot to get a good travel card. Too late for that trip, and it'll keep going and going. So my tip is, actually take action right now. Go and get the card. It doesn't cost anything to just hold on to it if there's no balance on it. So go and do that. I think that's a pretty good piece of advice, if I may say so myself. Not advice, tip, because, you know, rules, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, stick around, because straight after this, I believe Sammy Ellard King is about to step into the studio. Financial educator. Like I said, if you haven't seen him, you probably don't have social media. We'll see you then.
Foodbar Radio.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me, and I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some free videos come through.
Oh, tell us a little bit more.
You
go there? Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
Politics Uncensored.
I felt like it was a little bit, they wanted to go viral. They wanted the clip to end up on socials and be able to go viral, and there was nothing substantive on it. So to be honest, it kind of pissed me off because I thought it was a throwaway comment made for social media as opposed to actually giving voters information they need when they enter the voting booth.
Totally agree. And I also found the whole, I think you said something about Keir Starmer's strings being pulled by senior members of the Labour Party. I found that slightly conspiratorial.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello and welcome back to FUBAR Radio. I am Gabriel, That Money Guy. This is That Money Show. And joining me in the studio is Sammy Eldking, financial advisor. Sammy, how are you doing? Welcome to the studio.
Thanks. I'm good. I'm excited to be here, man.
Yeah, it's good to have you down because I know you're not a Londoner, so we put in a lot of effort to get you into the studio today. myself and Sammy obviously know each other, both financial creators, both been, you know, working our way at trying to make just the average person better with their money. Mm. Hopefully they're in a good job. We'll find out based on from the interview today. But I mean, like, let's go to the roots, because I've never asked you this. I've been on your podcast. Mm. You're now on my radio show, so it's a nice little back and forth. But what made you get into this in the first place?
Yeah, my journey's a little bit different to, say, like, standard financial advisors or accountants and things like that out there. I'm completely self-taught. I just fell in love with learning about money. And then basically I'm from a marketing background. Mm-hmm. But then I was deep in debt in my mid-20s. So I had £24,000 worth of consumer debt.
Wow.
Credit cards, personal loans, you name it. I had it. Payday loans, using loans to pay off loans and all of that jazz. I was in a really bad hole. Hadn't told anyone about it. And then essentially had my aha moment and basically managed to turn it all around, like dived into learning about money and just kind of spotted at the time. It was only really Martin Lewis. Now there's lots of people talking about money, which is fantastic. But at the time, there really wasn't anyone other than Martin, and everything was American or needed a bloody Oxford dictionary, basically. So that's where I came into this, was sort of seeing a little gap and wanting to help people as well.
Just sharing kind of your own learnings, your own advice, your own journey, because ultimately some people feel out of touch with the education they see online, right? They see the flashy cars. That's what they see when they associate financial advice, get rich quick, all of those kind of ideas. Yeah. Where yours is very much the opposite. The average person probably does have some level of consumer debt. Mm-hmm. They probably are struggling. They've got no idea how to get out of it. They've never had any education on the topic. So you're bringing relatability back to it. And you're not a fancy financial advisor. There's no like diplomas, everything there. It's like you said, if you can teach it to yourself, then why can't anyone do that?
Exactly.
So what are your key financial messages? And I know that's a hard one, because if someone asked me that, I'd slap them, because I'd be like, I don't know which one to pick. But like, what are the kind of key things that you would tell to someone starting from, you know, level zero?
Yeah, level zero is just understanding what compounding can do for you. So a very small amount of money over a long period of time can actually turn into a very large portion of money. And, you know, I'm sure you've probably heard of it before, but people just... Basically, our brains compute like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They don't compute like 2, 4, 8, 16. And that's basically what compound interest is doing. It's earning interest on top of your interest. So if you earned, let's say you have £100 and you earn 5% on it, that's £105. Mm-hmm. When the next year you're earning interest on that £105. And what happens is, yes, in the year one, year two, these are small amounts, but over a long, long period of time, that turns into thousands of pounds. And just by putting that £100 into your bank and getting 5% interest from it, for example. So
compound interest, the eighth wonder of the world, right?
Absolutely.
Someone
absolutely.
Says Albert Einstein said that. Albert. I feel like we probably need to fact check it because I've heard that said so many times. Albert Einstein once said that compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. Did he? Was he not doing physics and stuff? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. And we'll look into that off the show unless anyone wants to comment in and be like, he absolutely did not say that. There is no record of him. But there's a reason behind the saying, right? I'd like to bring it back to a little bit of like sensibility. It's an incredible fact that most people don't understand. They don't understand the power of, like you mentioned, the time impact of putting money away. And like you said, watching it kind of become steeper and steeper as it grows and grows and grows and grows. But some people do know about it and yet still aren't kind of convinced to make the leap. They think about, okay, compound interest sounds great if I had a bit more money, or, you know, compound interest is great, but where do we actually get those kind of returns from? Or compound interest sounds great, but not for me. So how do you start to convince someone to actually take action on taking the benefits of compound interest?
Yeah, well, it all begins with your why. Like, what are you doing it for? Whether that's your family, yourself, like you are going, we've all got goals out there, and usually there's a monetary goal. And the ultimate goal is that we don't want to work forever, right? And we want to try and kind of buy back some time. And by doing this, either by saving or investing in a regular format, is really your only way for the everyday person listening to this to be actually able to do that. Because, you know, a lot of us don't have, you know, 100 grand to chuck on a house and, you know, start a property portfolio. That's not really what it is. But with this, you can get started with as little as a pound these days. There's amazing platforms out there that allow you to do that. So just by getting started, and really it's about creating habits. Habits take 90 days to form. So that's three pay cycles. So if you can get yourself into a habit with this over three pay cycles, you're more than likely going to continue it over a long period of time. And one thing I feel like people do a lot of the time is comparison. And comparison is a thief of joy. And really, when you look at it, personal finance is personal. If you lined up 1,000 people all earning 30K, there wouldn't be one budget the same, not down. Mm-hmm. Even if I could extrapolate that to a billion people, and I guarantee you wouldn't be one the same down to the last penny, just because there's so many variables. So personal finance is unique to you. So comparing your journey to somebody else or thinking, oh, I'll get started next year, it's just going to hold you back. And as we were saying before, compound interest really takes off with the thing called time. So the more time you can give it, even if you're putting £10, £5 just to get started, will massively pay off in the long term.
Yeah. So I'm addicted to something online. That's a really weird sentence to say out loud, but it's called a compound interest calculator.
Yeah.
Get to that point very quickly. Don't leave people like with question marks about what I was going to say there. Compound interest calculator. It's like the funnest tool to play with, right? Because you can literally go online and it's a calculator where you plug in, you know, how much do I want to save? What kind of interest do I think I could get realistically? Yeah. Whether that's through, we haven't even mentioned this, whether it's through saving or investing, because they're kind of the two key mechanisms that people can use to take advantage of it.
Yes.
You play around with the numbers and you'll start to be absolutely shocked by the biggest impact isn't the amount or the percentage that you're getting in return. It's actually the length of time you can put it away for. Mm-hmm. So I think even this morning I was playing around with my pension. And I was like, if I withdrew it at 55 and didn't put another penny in, what would it be on? And it was doing pretty well, I'm not going to lie. It was like the pension, I saved quite aggressively into my pension. But then I said, well, what if it's more realistic? When I'm retiring, the actual retirement age will probably be around 70, let's be honest. What if I left it till then? It was 8 times larger.
Wow.
An extra 15 years on top.
That's
8
insane.
Times larger. And I just looked at it like, huh? Like what?
Maybe. Yes.
Yeah, I was like, I ain't retiring ever. I ain't retiring until I'm 90. So that's really cool. But obviously, we might confuse people. So firstly, go and check out a compound interest calculator and play around with it. It's a really fun tool and it probably is the thing that will spark you into life. Mm. But people will now say, okay, am I going to take advantage of this through saving or investing?
Yeah.
What's the difference? How can I decide which one is right for me?
It's a great question. So I have a really simple rule. It's called the 5-year rule. And essentially any money that you may need in the next 5 years, that needs to be saved into high interest savings account. Any money that you're happy to contribute to it 5 years or more, This money that you're potentially happy to take a little bit more risk of because you don't need it in the near term, and that money should be invested. Now, when it comes to saving or investing, you will have some short-term goals. People listen to this. I want to buy my first house. I want to save for that dream holiday, that car that the missus wants, or whatever those kind of conversations that are happening in your household. But that's, again, it's unique to you. You know what those goals are. So you can basically allocate portions of your money. So if you're saving £100 again, you might say, I'm going to save 60%, I'm going to invest 40%. You might say, I'm going to do 80-20 based on your goals, because again, they'll be unique to you. But saving is still very important. And I'm a big believer, once you get your emergency fund cooking and you've got that going, a lot of gurus out there say 3 to 6 months. I think that's a lot of money for a lot of people listening to this. So start with the first grand, and then top it up as you go, and then start investing alongside that. But yeah, saving and investing go hand in hand, short-term goals, long-term goals, and they should be viewed very differently, but still contributed to at both at the same time, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a brilliant way of explaining it, because they are both as important as each other, right? Mm. Obviously, your short-term goals sometimes feel more important because they're more impending. Mm. But the other thing is, the long-term goals become more achievable the earlier you start, and it's constantly pulling at each other, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something to definitely look at. So saving, I think most people do understand to some extent. They know, you know, you put your money away, you try and find the best interest rate. Mm-hmm. Please do actually go out there and try and find the best interest rate. If you have anything below 3 right now in terms of the percentage, mm-hmm. I would highly recommend you to start moving your money.
It's like 66% of people are now earning under 2%.
That makes me feel sick.
It's mad, isn't it?
You can get 5 right now, 5%. Yeah. And that's not even fixed away. That's easy access. I won't say where. We're not going to be sponsored by anyone, but just Google it. Just Google best interest rate accounts, and it's very easy to find. People always ask me, like, where's the best one? And I'm like, I don't actually have the up-to-date standings as of today, but Google is really good at that. So that's the kind of like tip for that. But in terms of investing, that's where most people go, I don't know how. What I say to most people is, like, just start. Make it up. Use a tiny amount of your money and just start, because ultimately the platform doesn't matter what you invest into. As long as it's a diversified, you know, global index fund or something of that sort to start with, doesn't really matter the intricate details of, again, which one, because if it's a tiny amount that you're just testing the money with, that's a really good way to get started. But what are kind of the things that you say to someone that's like, I just investing, it seems like a black hole to me?
Yeah, first place to start is getting yourself a stocks and shares ISA, mm-hmm. and that's really where you should begin. And people think, oh, even still, that's like, whoa, that's a big decision.
There's a lot of words there.
Yeah, he just said stocks and shares. What? So there are different types of stocks and shares ISAs. There are DIY ISAs, so do it yourself. We all know what that means. And there are robo-advisors, so that's when you jump on and you ask a bunch of questions based on who you are. Again, it's unique to you. And the computer, or an AI these days, will basically create you a portfolio based on the answers that you give it. It's things like, how much risk are you happy taking? When are you retiring? How old you are? These types of questions. So you can jump on there and use those if you don't want to do it yourself. And then the last one is an expert managed. So that's actually working with a human being to then go and ask these questions, but you're actually chatting to a human if you don't like the computer and AI versions. And so you can just get started. If you feel like you need a little bit more of a helping hand, you could start with an expert managed. And the beautiful thing about ISAs is you can transfer it. So 4 years down the line, I feel like I've got enough knowledge now. I want to do this myself. Transfer your ISA over into a DIY ISA. The thing is, with expert managed and robo advisors, usually they come with a little bit more fees. And that's something you definitely need to watch out for when you open an account. You don't want to go with ones at high fees, because even like a percent over a long period of time ends up being tens of thousands of pounds that you've lost in returns just to fees.
I think that's a really good point. And I'll be honest here. I obviously do financial education online myself. I started with a robo-advisor.
Yeah.
That's how I started. I didn't know investing. I didn't know where to invest into, but I knew that starting was super important. So I just, like you said, got it to build a portfolio for me. And at that point, when I didn't have a lot invested, the fees weren't that detrimental to me early on. And like you said, as I did it, I learned more. And as I learned more, I realized I could do it myself. And then I switched it over. Now I didn't actually end up paying too many fees because I didn't have that much invested in the first place. And now I've been able to do it. So yeah. Really don't let it get started. And I think the other thing I always like to add on top, and this is something I'm saying more and more to people, is stop scrolling. Stop like looking up more investing terms and looking up more of this and more of that, because ultimately the person that knows absolutely everything but never actually got started will be a million miles behind the person that just, you know, got that one thing, that one piece of information. They knew how to open the account. They tested it with a, you know, like you said, a quid, £1 to do it. And they learned, and that kind of snowball effect to the knowledge got better and better. Because you can always use the excuse of, I need to learn one more thing. But it's just not true, ultimately. 100%. You'll learn way more from kind of the action. What things should people be aware of? What are the kind of the risks involved? Because I think it's also important to state those.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And one thing I would say as well, just before we talk about risk, is that most of you listening to this are already investing inside of your pension.
There we go.
That's happening now, without whether you like it or not. But we just suddenly feel weird when that money is then paid as net income into our account, and then we've got to invest it. It's like, oh my God. So you could just go and copy what your pension is doing if your pension's getting you good results, and that, because that is what's happening. So yeah, that's what I would say. But then when it comes to risk, yes, there is risk when you invest. Everybody understands that. But the thing is, the longer you invest for, the less risk there is. There was a study done by Schroders, who are a big investment firm. And if you invest for 10 years or more, so let's say you put £100 in today, in 10 years or more, the chances of you losing money are under 1%. And if that goes to 15 years, it's 0.1%.
Crazy.
So if I said to you today, hey, there's a 99% chance you're going to make money if you do this thing, pretty much 10 out of 10 of us are doing
we're all gonna do it.
So it's when you get that into your mind, and that's why we say long term, and that's why that 5-year rule works, because realistically 5 years we can't really say what's going to happen. But if you scan out and look at, say, a index fund stock chart, you literally press max on Google, it's all you need to do, you'll literally see like, oh, it's going one way and it's going up, and that is what the stock market is basically designed to do. It's designed to rise.
I'll do you one better. I believe that the worst 30-year return, which is quite a long period of time to obviously invest your money, but the worst ever 30-year return of the American stock market, plus 7.8% annually. That's the worst one that they've ever recorded.
30 years,
over 30 years. Over 20, it becomes +2 or +2.5 or something like that.
Crazy.
Obviously, there are bad periods, but that is the worst ever combined 20-year period. So, yeah, I feel like that speaks volumes. I want to ask you to kind of give one other piece of tip, advice, knowledge that you wish someone would know just before we end this interview. Because I always like to let someone, you know, that one gem that someone listening, as they've listened to the interview, they're really inspired, but this is the one thing that will push them over the edge to improve their finances.
Yeah. So basically, working out your financial freedom number, it's like the most important thing, even if you don't actually end up getting to it, just knowing what it looks like for you. So basically, take your income, times it by 25, and that will give you your financial freedom number. And that is where the number, if you hit that number, you could take 4% from it each year and live the exact same life that you're living now during your retirement, whether that's an extended retirement, early retirement, or just a normal retirement. That's going to leave you with like super comfortable. Once someone said that to me, it changed my life, basically. So I would 100% recommend everybody go and do that.
Well, let's hope you've just changed someone's life right now. Sammy, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciated you coming down here.
Thanks, man.
And everyone go and calculate your financial freedom number. Or some people call it the FU number. Cheers. All right, so we are now going to dive into some questions that you guys have asked. We always tell you that you can DM us at That Money Show on Instagram and ask us any question you want, and we will answer it live on this show. I mean, what better deal do you have than that? We've only got time for one, but I will answer it nonetheless. So Richard has said that he struggles with saving money each month with the price of everything going up. What's the best way to create a budget that actually works for me? Well, that's great, because me and Sammy were just talking about how personal finance is personal. So it has to be done to you. So Richard, this is exactly what I would say to you, and the best way to set up a budget. Number one is, for the past 3 months, take a look back and look at your average spending in your main categories of your needs, the things that you have to spend on, okay? Now put those out. Those are going to have to come out of next month's paycheck, but what you're going to try and do with the rest of it is see if you can put as much of that as possible towards savings. What can you cut back? What are the things that you want but you don't need? So in theory, theoretically, there's this rule called the 50-30-20 rule, where you put 50% of your money towards wants, towards needs, 30% towards wants, and 20% towards savings. Now, the truth is, you can actually play around with that 50 and 30 number. You can make it 60-20. You can make it 70-10. You can make it 55-25. Okay? But the ideal is, can you get that saving number? And that's saving towards everything, towards future holidays, towards your house deposit, towards your long-term savings, investments, pensions. Can you get that number towards 20%? So what you're going to do, Richard, like I told you, is actually print out your bank account, go back 3 months, work out those needs, and start from there. Because I feel like most people don't use the actual data that they have within their bank account. Anyway, that's all we got time for. So sorry if I didn't get around to answering your questions. I promise I will try much harder next week to get around to them. But you can always DM us at That Money Show on Instagram to ask us some questions, and hopefully they will feature in next week's show. Remember, you can find us on every podcasting platform if you want to listen back to this and share it with your friends. You can also download the FUBAR Radio app and listen to us live at 4 p.m. every single Monday. I want to say a quick thank you to Sammy, to also Dr. Matt. I have been Gabriel. This is That Money Show. I am That Money Guy, and you are officially better with your money.